equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenauer, your host for Equal Time Radio. We got a great show coming up. The main guest today is Jeff Mapes. He's the author of Pedaling Revolution. It's about how bicyclists have become a political force and what bicyclists really want. Also joining the conversation about bicycling in Vermont in the last half of the show will be Nancy Schultz. She's a director of the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition. John Zaccone, he's from the Agency of Transportation. And Willem Jewett joining us here in the studio, an avid cyclist in the legislature. But first, we're going to have the first of a number of special features, a new series of special features that we're going to start occasionally with Morgan Downey. If you were listening a couple months ago, you might remember our conversation with Morgan Downey about his book Oil 101, which is just a phenomenal look at the oil industry, where oil comes from dinosaurs to the present, and how the oil industry developed from a scarcity of whales in the 19th century to what it is today, to how oil markets work today. And Morgan will be joining us from time to time to talk about the latest in the oil industry. Morgan, welcome back to Equal Time.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Good, thanks. So, what's going on with the price of oil? Gasoline's going up.
Yep, it has indeed. Well, it's gone up since the beginning of the year. We've had almost a 50% increase in the price of gasoline since the beginning of the year. But interestingly, over the last 3 months, since the beginning of June, we've had this kind of consolidation and sideways movement in prices. And I think that one of the main reasons for that is that we've got up to a price level now at $70, $71 per barrel that the oil market, both consumers and producers, are kind of comfortable with this level for the moment. So I think we're seeing the oil market moving sideways, as we have seen over the last 3 months. We've also been very fortunate so far this year not to have any major hurricanes, touch wood, yet. And, you know, that is a concern over the next, usually hurricane season peaks at the end of August, beginning of September. But so far, we've been fortunate in that weather has not been a factor.
Hurricanes were a big factor in 2005 in sending up prices.
They were indeed. They were sent prices quite a bit higher and resulted in shortages in various Gulf Coast states.
So what do you see happening with prices now for the rest of the summer? We got about, a month left until the oil refiners go from the summer to the winter blend of gasoline?
Yep, we do indeed. I think that for now, I think that most people see that the upside for the next 3 to 6 months is quite limited in terms of pricing. I think that you've got a situation where the economy is still not back to full health. You know, it's recovering, but it's still very weak. And so there's the demand growth that we saw that led to the rapid run-up in prices last year and the year before is not there. That demand is still quite weak. And you've got OPEC has taken quite a lot of oil supply from the market. But that means that they have the ability to supply the market with a lot more oil if prices head higher. So I think that on the upside, I think that, you know, we're $71 today. We might get up to $80 to $90, but I don't think we're going to see triple-digit prices anytime over the next 3 months or 6 months. So I think the outlook for oil prices is a kind of a sideways movement for the next 3 to 6 months.
And looking at the longer term, over the next decade or so, we saw in the news in the last week that Fatih Birol, the chief economist for the International Energy Agency in Paris, was saying he expects world oil production to peak within the next 10 years, which is later than some people are saying, but it's a lot earlier than what IEA used to be talking about not too long ago.
Yeah, I think it was a very significant statement by the head of economics at the International Energy Agency. They had previously been saying that we're not going to see any major supply issues until the year 2030, which, you know, is kind of beyond, you know, the realm of planning for most individuals. So, but them saying that that they're seeing I think they called it the term supply crunch, beginning in 2012 and lasting up to 2020. I think that was a very significant change in their stance. And the International Energy Agency is, of course, the energy advisor to the 30 most developed countries, so including the US and European countries and Canada and so on, and Japan. So that was a very significant change of stance for them, saying that they're seeing a lack of supply in quite an imminent way. You know, 2-3 years is a very short period of time, and in terms of trying to plan to deal with that situation. And so that was a very significant change in stance from the International Energy Agency.
Very good. Well, Morgan Downey, the author of Oil 101, thanks so much for joining us this month.
Thank you, Carl.
Okay, bye. And for the rest of the show, we will be talking about bikes and bicycling. Our main guest is Jeff Mapes, the author of Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. But before I forget, I just want to mention a couple things I learned about on the way in here. I was bicycling in from East Montpelier, about 60 miles into Waterbury, and I came across this row of kids on the sidewalk on their bicycles waiting to cross the street, I believe, and they were from Bike Around Waterbury. Now, I'd seen this line of kids bicycling in Waterbury before. I didn't know what it was all about, but since I was going to be talking about biking, I stopped and I met Jason Porter, who's been running this summer camp for about 6 years. And he was taking the kids to the Waterbury Bicycle Park, and they're doing all sorts of things with bicycle safety and bicycle rodeos and just having a good time in a summer camp around bicycles. Just warmed the cockles of my heart. He said that 850 kids this year are going through that, and the older ones are riding on the street, learning how to ride safely as a vehicle on the street, and the younger ones are just playing around on their bikes. And then when I got into WDEV here, Giff told me about the Village Grocery in Waitsfield, where the owner has green bikes. There, you can stop by and borrow a bicycle. He just wants to get people out on bicycles. So that was good to hear about. But we're going to be talking with Jeff Mapes for the first half of the show, and then we'll have three other guests in the second half of the show joining us. Nancy Schultz from the Vermont Bike and Ped Coalition. That's the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition. John Zaccone from the Agency of Transportation, and Willem Jewett, an avid cyclist in the legislature here. Jeff Mapes, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Loved hearing that story about the kids this morning.
All right.
That's great.
And I should mention also that your phone calls are welcome. Our number here is 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Well, let's begin to a question to you, Jeff Mapes, as a senior political reporter in Portland, Oregon, for the newspaper The Oregonian. I don't know how things work out there in Oregon, but if it's anything like the newspaper business out here, the journalists try to, you know, remain aloof from the political organizations that they're covering so as to not to appear to have a conflict of interest. And yet you do reporting on bicycling, you've written this book on bicycling, and you ride a lot of bicycles too.
Yeah, to be fair, as a political reporter for the paper, I don't write a lot about bicycling. I did write some articles as I was first starting out on this book, but I really don't. And actually, we do, the Oregonian, where I work, does quite a bit of coverage of cycling issues now because it's become such a major source of transportation in town. And I pretty much stay away from that now. Really, you know, when I wrote this book, I set out, I was curious at what was happening with the movement, and I set out to do a journalistic examination of it. But I didn't feel at the same time that I was going to hide my own love of cycling, and so this is the book I came up with.
There are no neutral parties here. You drive a car too. You write in the book.
That's true. You know, and in fact, you know, that you raise a very good point. Does a journalist have a bias if he or she drives to work every day?
Mm-hmm. And just to put my biases out on the table, I'm a member of the local, state, and national bicycle organizations. I bicycle commute all winter, all year round, including in the winter in Vermont. And I teach effective cycling or safe bicycling under the League of American Bicyclists. So, but I also, our family owns two cars, and I drive one of them.
Yeah, I am definitely multimodal, no doubt about that.
Hmm. So you've seen in Portland a real bicycling renaissance in the last 15 years, and that's reflective of what's happening nationwide, I guess.
Yeah, and Portland, I think, is really ahead of the curve. I mean, we're we're starting to see the beginnings of what we saw in Portland several years ago really taking off in a lot of cities. You know, if you'd come to Portland, say 15 years ago, you wouldn't have been particularly struck by the number of cyclists or thought, you know, anything unusual about the city. And really, just in that period of time now, we've gotten to the point where it's virtually impossible for me to go out on the streets at any time of day or night and not see another cyclist. The city auditor does a study every year, and 8% of Portlanders in the study that was done just about a year ago, there should be a new one soon, 8% said that the bicycle was their primary means of commute. We have some neighborhoods now where I'd say really even bigger than neighborhoods, some quadrant sections of the city where you have 25 to 30% of residents saying that bicycling is either their primary or secondary means of transportation.
Well, that must really have some implications for how much money the city is spending on street maintenance and repair, parking spaces, a whole raft of things.
Yeah, I mean, it is really starting to change the look and feel of the city. Now, the city has not spent a great deal of money, relatively speaking, on bicycling, certainly more than a lot of cities have, but it's, you know, a lot of it is pretty cheap stuff, but, you know, you do, bike lanes are very common around the city. Another thing that really in the last few years has taken, just really taken off, are what are called bike corrals, where the city is taken out. Typically, it'll be two parking spaces, and then put in several bike racks right in a row and protected by little, you know, curbs. And you know, in that space you can, where before you could park maybe two cars, you can now park, 15 or so bicycles. And the interesting thing, at least to me about it, is it's not like these are going in over the objections of merchants. Merchants are asking for these bike corrals.
15 bicycles carries more customers than two cars.
Exactly right, unless you have those cars really, really jammed full of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's particularly popular, coffee shops, restaurants, things like that, oftentimes really like having these bike corrals.
Do you have valet bike parking in Portland?
Sometimes you'll see, I don't know about valet park bike parking, it's called that, I don't know if it's quite that, but you'll see that oftentimes at festivals and special events, things like that, you will see bike parking. You know, it's interesting when Barack Obama was campaigning for president, his largest crowd during the primary season was in Portland, something like
100,000 people, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was about 80,000 showed
huge.
Up out on Waterfront Park, and the candidate was so struck by the number of bikes just locked to everything. I mean, there were just thousands of bikes locked up down in this Waterfront Park, you know, along the seawall. There's kind of a long iron fence along there and on the bridge, the closest bridge nearby. I mean, people were just using everything they could find because it was really the logical way to get to this gigantic rally, you know, because, you know, parking would be very difficult, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that was just an example of, once again, where you're just very struck by what happens in Portland. Well, I'll give you one more quick example. On the Hawthorne Bridge now, which is probably, is definitely the most popular cycling bridge in the city. It's a major route for cyclists to get from the east side where most people live to the downtown on the west side of the Willamette River, and something like 20% of the traffic now going over that bridge are cyclists. There's a 10.5-foot wide path on either side of paths on either side of the bridge, and during rush hour now there's real congestion problems, particularly, you know, between pedestrians and cyclists, and it's, you know, just simply not turning out to be enough space.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Carl Etner. We're talking with Jeff Mapes. He's the author of Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. And this is about American cities. So let's take it a little bit wider. And can you tell us, you use a phrase, virtuous circle, about getting cyclists out on the street a bunch of times in this book, Jeff Mapes. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, that is a very important theme in the book. And one of the things that has really been studied, and there's pretty good documentation for it, and it makes a lot of intuitive sense, is the idea of safety in numbers. And the more people you get out cycling, the safer it is for everybody. And when you think about it, I mean, it really does make a lot of sense. If you go by, say you drive by a schoolyard every day, well, you get pretty accustomed to seeing groups of kids crossing the street, et cetera, at certain times of day. So you learn to watch out for them. If you see a lot of cyclists around, then you know you're going to learn to watch more carefully for them as a motorist, and frankly, you know, the greater numbers, they're more visible. So the more people who are out cycling, the safer it feels for people to cycle, and the more people who do cycle. And in fact, the studies show that it is safer. One thing that we've had in Portland, as ridership has exploded over the last 10 or 15 years, I mean, it's like triple or quadruple what it was back in the early 90s. What they found at the city is that the crash rate has, or the number of crashes, has not really gone up. It stayed pretty flat, which means the rate, of course, has gone way down. So I think that, you know, is important. I mean, it's like, you know, when people feel more comfortable walking on a street when other people are on a sidewalk, you know, say a particular neighborhood, when they see more other people out on the sidewalk. So that's what I mean by a virtuous circle.
I've noticed that in Montpelier, we don't have good long-term data on cyclist numbers, but my impression is there are a lot more cyclists winter and summer in Montpelier now than there were 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, it would frequently happen that I'd come to an intersection or the roundabout wearing yellow in the middle of the day, and a driver would cut me off. And you know, if I ever stopped and talked to the person, they'd usually say, "Oh, I didn't see you." And I can't remember the last time that's happened now. We have a lot more cyclists on the road, and I don't get cut off. People are more aware of cyclists out there.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a response from motorists. I oftentimes, the main street through downtown Portland is called Broadway. I often ride along it to work in the morning. It's a one-way street with a bike lane in the far right of the street. And I've noticed that increasingly in recent years, that motorists, when they come to the intersection now, look over their right shoulder to make sure that no cyclists are coming before they turn right.
Mm.
And increasingly I see that form of behavior that I didn't used to. In fact, the first time I really saw motorists really watching carefully for cyclists, well, I have to say the first time I saw it was in Davis, a university town in California where cycling has long been a very major form of transportation. And also in the Netherlands, you see drivers there very calm about just sort of the hordes of cyclists going around them because they've been accustomed to it. It's how they learned how to drive.
Hmm. Well, you didn't use this phrase in your book, Jeff Mapes, in your book, Pedaling Revolution, but I plugged this show by saying we'd be talking about what do cyclists really want? And how would you answer that question?
Well, you know, that is a very interesting question, and it isn't always the same depending on, you know, what kind of cyclist we're talking about. Like everybody else, there's lots of different kinds. There's recreational cyclists, you know, the men and women who are mostly out riding, you know, in their Lycra, fast road bikes, you know, they're looking for one thing. I think people who want a comfortable commute to work maybe are looking for another thing. But I think there's a couple things that are very simple. One, they are looking for respect and to be noticed. I think that's a very important part of this is the cultural change. And I think also another important part is to just take this mode of transportation into account when you're doing transportation planning, when a city is trying to decide what, you know, configuration on their streets or how to modify, you know, intersections, approaches to bridges, that sort of thing. So I think part of it is simply being considered and being part of the mix.
And in your book, Pedaling Revolution, you describe what's happened to increase facilities for cyclists in a number of American cities and also some European cities. And it seems in a lot of these stories that the mayor riding a bicycle was an important part of the picture.
It is funny how that happens. One story I didn't really get into in the book because it really was happening kind of when I was in the final editing stage. But for years, Boston has made like Bicycling Magazine's list of, you know, the 10 worst American cities for cyclists, that sort of thing. Many years ago, they had a bicycle coordinator, and then they didn't replace them. And the Boston mayor, Mayor Menino, I think it is.
That's right.
He had never really expressed much interest in it. And a couple summers ago, I think his doctor told him he had to get more exercise or something, and he started cycling, found that he liked it, and the city now has a, you know, very aggressive bike coordinator. They're starting to do some things there, and it was. I have seen this in city around the country. It's not always the mayor, although that often makes a big difference. Chicago is another main example of this, but oftentimes it will just take one or two very well positioned people to really start to make a difference.
Well, I did tried to do a quick survey yesterday of mayors in this state of Vermont. And, of course, I knew Mary Hooper, the mayor of Montpelier, who bicycles into downtown and back and through much of the year. And she's also a state representative, bicycles down to the legislature. Our nearby city of Barrie didn't get a call back from Tom Lozen, the mayor there. Burlington, that's our huge city here on the lake. We have 40,000 people all together in one place in that city. And the mayor, Bob Kiss, I talked to his office and was told that he generally walks to work. He doesn't take his bicycle. The mayors of St. Albans, the following mayors did not get back to me at all. St. Albans, Martin Manahan, Winooski, Michael O'Brien, Rutland, Chris Loris, Vergennes, Michael Daniels, left messages, and Newport, Paul Monette. So left messages for them, told them what I wanted to talk about, and they didn't get back to me. So you can interpret that how you will.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, in Portland, every year there is a ride that is sort of, what do they call it, like sort of a Portland leaders ride or something. But at any rate, they sort of try to get as many political leaders and civic leaders to go on this. You know, it'll maybe be a 20-30 mile ride through the region to kind of look at various bikeways and things like that, give a sense of what it's like to ride. And one of the agencies that really takes a lead role in a lot of this is Metro, which is our regional government that's in charge of a lot of planning issues and transportation. And it's, in fact, I believe one of the only two or three elected regional government agencies in the country. But at any rate, I was on that ride a couple years ago, and every single member of the Metro Council was on this ride and went the full duration.
Wow.
So in Portland, cyclists have become, you know, I won't say they're more powerful than a couple of well-connected developers, but, you know, they've become a political force. There's just no doubt about it.
And you tell numerous stories in the book about how cyclists have worked with developers in different places. But I want to get to a little unconventional argument about cycling. We can talk about its the bicycle's use in transportation, its convenience, and its health effects. But one of the points that you make in the book is that by providing good facilities for bicyclists, cities can attract young people to come and move there. Here in Vermont, we're faced with an aging population, a declining population, and there are various opinions about whether that's good or bad. But for people who do want to retain and attract young people, is investing in bicycle facilities a good way to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting argument, and it's a little bit, you can argue, maybe a chicken and egg thing. I mean, over the last, and I'll use Portland again because it's the example I'm the most familiar with, but it does apply to some other cities. Over the last 15 or 20 years, Portland has become a real mecca for 20-something college graduates. Now, we're not a center of higher education like, say, Boston is, but we have an amazing number of young people who move here after getting their college degree. They like the city's, you know, it's funny how that word indie, you know, for independent gets attached to so many different things in Portland. The indie theater scene, the indie food scene, software, you know, we're a big center of open source development, writers, artists, I mean, you name it. And one of the things that attracts them is that Portland is one of the least expensive West Coast cities, in part because you can move here, find a house or an apartment with a bunch of friends, and you don't need a car. You can get around the city by public transit and by your bike. And so that's really an attractive thing for people who are really looking to do something creative and, you know, maybe not be earning a lot of money while they're doing that.
That's a huge expense that comes off of your budget if you don't have to have a car,
right.
And that's all before taxes.
Right, exactly right.
Or after taxes, I should say.
Yeah, and so then the question becomes, well, how much, you know, are the people bringing their, in essence, their cheap form of transportation here, or are they adopting it? And I think it's a little bit of both, you know. I mean, people who like the idea of, gee, I can get around the city by bike, that's a neat thing. I think that's part of it, and it attracts people. Other people, maybe they don't have much interest in it, but they say, hey, my friend's here, they're living on $400 or $500 a month, and I'd love to be able to do that. And they get here, and, you know, part of the reason they're able to do that is because they can ride their bike around, not necessarily as the entire way that they get around town, but certainly, as part of that.
It's part of that virtuous circle that you were talking about earlier.
Right, right, yeah.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Jeff Mapes. He's the author of Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. I'm Carl Etnayer. This is Equal Time. And coming up, we'll be joined by a number of Vermonters who have a strong relationship to bicycling of one type or another. Nancy Schultz, she's the director of the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition. John Zaccone, he's the director of Planning, Outreach, and Community Affairs at the Vermont Agency of Transportation. And Willem Jewett, he's an avid cyclist in the Vermont Legislature. We'll be back right after this.
I got a bicycle. I got it for my birthday. It takes me everywhere I want to go. It's shiny and silver with a white wicker basket. I can't wait to show it off to all my friends. When I get home from school, I get on my bicycle. I ride it in circles and never get tired. When I wake in the morning, it's the first thing I think of and the last thing I see when I turn out the light. 'Cause I feel happy when the wind's at my back and I'm going as fast as I can. I feel so alive. I can't feel sad when the wind's at my back and I'm going so fast that the only thing I can feel is the spin of my bicycle.
That's Bicycle Song by Susanna Clifford Blatchley.
Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer, and we're talking with Jeff Mapes. He's the author of Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. And now in the second half of the show, we'll be welcoming some guests from Vermont. Jeff Mapes is a reporter out in Portland, Oregon. We'll be talking with Nancy Schultz, director of the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition. Nancy, welcome to the show. And John Zaccone, the director of Planning, Outreach, and Community Affairs at the Agency of Transportation. Hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks.
And we have here in the studio, has been with us since the beginning of the show, Willem Jewett, who's in the legislature and bicycles around a lot. Willem, welcome.
Afternoon. Happy to be here.
Good to have you all. Why don't we start out with Nancy Schultz, the speaker for the bicycle advocate community in Vermont, at least a statewide organization. Tell us about the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition, what your work is.
Well, we're an education and advocacy organization. Membership supported, and we advocate at the state level for safer conditions for runners, walkers, and bicyclists. We also do educational programs for youth and adults and organize social outings, a number of things. Willem and I work together to have a bike with your legislator day earlier this year in honor of Earth Day.
Hmm. And why don't you get in a plug for your annual gathering next month?
Oh, fantastic. Yes, our annual outing will be Saturday, September 12th in Woodstock, and it's an opportunity for people to come together and go on guided walks and bike rides, share lunch, and then hear a wonderful presentation from the state's bicycle and pedestrian program manager, John Kaplan, on his five-country European tour in May, in which he studied best practices and infrastructure for bicyclists and pedestrians.
John Kaplan, as a Agency of Transportation's bike and ped coordinator, we'd asked him to be on this show. He agreed to be on this show on Monday, and then got rain in Watkins Glen on Sunday. It delayed the car race, and we were bumped to Wednesday, and he was unable to be here. So we're grateful to John Zaccone, the Director of Planning, Outreach, and Community Affairs, for pinch hitting. And John, can you summarize what the AOT's bike policy is?
Oh, AOT's bike policy is diverse and complicated, but I think in the sense that we're talking about here, when we do any kind of roadway project, whether it be simple repaving project or a complete reconstruction of a road or a bridge, that we take a look at bike and pedestrian, how it impacts bike and pedestrians, what we can do to make sure that they are accommodated. We can't make accommodations in every case, but we do need to look at all of our projects and understand what we can do, assess the costs and all that kind of thing. But it's incumbent upon us to make sure we keep the bicycle and pedestrian community in mind when we do anything that we do.
And Willem Jewett, sitting in the legislature, what's your view of bicycling in Vermont and bike advocacy and the way the state supports it?
Well, I got to say first, I just love this topic. I've lived all kinds of bike lives. When I was real young, the bike represented freedom for me. I was able to get around town and get out to Little League and whatnot. Listening to Jeff Mapes was great because I spent 3 years commuting from 27th and Clinton in the Southeast District up to the law school in Portland. But here in the legislature, you know, Jeff was talking a lot about American cities. Here in Vermont, we're not so much an American city. We're quite rural America, and we got to figure out how to work bikes into our rural landscape. I think we have some challenges because our legislature sits in a, shall we say, bike-unfriendly season of the year.
January through May.
Yeah, I mean, this is my eighth year coming up, and all those years we tried to organize this ride to the Statehouse Day. We finally managed it this year, but even that took a bunch of replanning because of the weather.
Yeah, and if I can, I think this is, William makes a good point, where we are a rural landscape here, and I think a lot of people think about our cities. Carl, you mentioned about bicycling through Montpelier, for instance, and sometimes it's difficult to do things there just because of the constraints of the roads. Where we can make a lot of inroads is in the rural landscape, looking at our main highways that run through the rural landscape, and understanding, for instance, from the Agency of Transportation's point of view, when we repave a road, where are there good gravel shoulders now that we can expand a little bit? We have a stormwater issue here in Vermont. We can't create new impervious surface without permits and a lot of expense, but where there is gravel, which is already an impervious surface, we can expand these roads, you know, your Route 2s, your Route 7s, your Route 105s, your Route 100s, and in the stretches where we can try to get a 3-foot shoulder where there is not one now, or somewhere close to it, or take a 12-foot travel lane for cars and shrink it to 11 foot so you can gain 2 feet, you know, both sides in order to expand that and make it easier for cyclists to ride through our countryside and, you know, commute from village to village along those roads or just go for a recreational ride. That's where a lot of our focus is and where we can make our greatest inroads. But we do that as we pave these roads. We don't have a program that does that independently. It's much cost-effective in order to do that when you've already got the equipment and you've got engineers out there assessing things. But that's where we try to make our biggest headway.
And that was John Zaccone from the Agency of Transportation. Jeff Mapes, author of Pedaling Revolution. You write in your book about the difference between cities and suburbs and how it's much easier to build up facilities for bicyclists in cities and suburbs. But as you've heard here in Vermont, we have a lot of rural areas. We have a lot of people bicycling in or commuting in from rather long distances and going out into rural areas for pleasure riding. What are your comments on bicycling facilities in rural areas?
Well, first off, I have to say it's fascinating just hearing the conversation and learning a lot here. I will confess that my book is primarily about cities because that's where I've seen the greatest resurgence, and you know where there is really something that is making some big change. But it's fascinating to hear what is going on in Vermont as well. And I think one thought I'm wondering about is what kind of rails to trails or other kinds of facilities you have there that also can serve as, kind of not just a recreation purpose, but a transportation purpose as well, perhaps between two towns or whatever.
The road that I was riding from Montpelier to Waterbury today has been newly marked as part of the Cross Vermont Trail. And John Zaccone, what does that mean?
This is where my pinch hitting for John Kaplan is probably going to not do this conversation a ton of good. John might have a better understanding of that. That's a little bit beyond my knowledge. I can talk, for instance, though, with Rails to Trails. We have several here, including a new one that's in progress, which is the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, which basically runs east-west almost through the entire state from the area of the St. Albans area all the way over through towards St. Johnsbury. And that's it's about 90 miles. It's an abandoned trail, abandoned 10-odd years ago. Senator Sanders was able to get us a $5 million earmark a few years ago, and we're working with VAST, which is the Vermont Association of Snow Travelers. Now, that's a snowmobile organization, but they're willing to do a lot of the work, and the grant was actually, the earmark was actually given to them. And in the summertime, of course, it can be used for bicycles, and part of their ability to have the money is that they will bring the trail up to snuff, not only for their own purposes, but for also bicycles and pedestrians in the summertime. So all the construction work and maintenance has to be done with that in mind. And that's a good chunk of getting from east to west in the northern part of the state, and we'll make a nice addition there once it's done.
Willem Jewett or Nancy Schultz, do you have an answer about the Cross Vermont Trail?
This is Nancy. I can fill in a little bit about that. The Cross Vermont Trail is essentially a 90-mile route that runs from Lake Champlain to the Connecticut River. And currently, you can bike or walk the entire thing. There are large sections on roads and large sections on trails. And eventually, when completed, I think the goal is to have as much of it as possible off-road. But that's why the signs are up now, so that people can follow the entire route. And there's a section, Carl, in East Montpelier that's completed, and I think the largest contiguous section is in Groton State Forest.
Hmm. Very good. Well, we're talking with a bevy of people about the book Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities by Jeff Mapes, who's on the phone with us, along with three Vermonters involved in cycling. I'm Carl Ettenayer. This is Equal Time Radio, and we'll be back to continue the conversation about big cycling issues in Vermont right after this. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Equal Time Radio. I'm Carl Ettenayer. We're talking with Jeff Mapes, the author of Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities, and also with Willem Jewett from the legislature, and John Zaccone, the Agency of Transportation, Nancy Schultz from the Bike Ped Coalition. Nancy Schultz, I want to go to you and ask, from the Vermont Bicycle and Pedestrian Coalition, what are some of the big bicycle issues on a statewide basis?
Oh, thanks for asking, Carl. I'm pleased that Jeff mentioned earlier that a real answer to improving safety is for more people to get out and ride. The number one thing I hear from people is that they'd like to ride more, but they're afraid. And it's again, it's a chicken and egg thing. It sounds almost counterintuitive that the way to be safer is to get out, put yourself out there in that situation that makes you feel uncomfortable. But it's true that if enough people do it, encountering a cyclist as a motorist won't be something surprising and shocking. It will be as routine as encountering a school bus or a tractor or something else that you need to navigate around. And so that's a message that we are continuously trying to get out in tandem with, yes, Vermont can do much more than it has historically to make our state more accommodating for pedestrians and bicyclists. John mentioned earlier the state's approach to accommodation, and the state does have a bike ped policy plan, but there's an interesting phrase that's woven throughout the plan that says, yes, the state will do such and such when reasonably feasible. And the state is, the AOT makes that determination as to when something's reasonably feasible, and if it's determined that it's not, then it doesn't happen.
John Zaccone, that sounds like a lot of wiggle room, and I've heard from cyclists around the state and seen it in Montpelier that the state doesn't always do things that, at least I think, would be reasonably feasible to do for cyclists. Your comments?
Well, I don't know what you're specifically citing, Carl, but I do know that there are limitations to what we can do. A lot of those limitations come down to money, of course. As I mentioned with earlier, with taking the rural roads and expanding the shoulders where you can, there are places you can't unless you move ditch lines and get into things like stormwater, and that can be quite expensive quite quickly. So when you've got a deteriorating road, you need to take care of and repave. If it's a $2 million project and it's going to cost an additional $2 million to move the ditch lines and get all the permits and buy the right-of-way and build stormwater treatment facilities, then that becomes a limiting factor, and you just can't do that there. It also has to do with the building sidewalks. Let's take a bridge for an example. You might have a historic bridge that you'd love to widen and make it easier for cyclists. I think a classic example in your listening area is the Checkerhouse Bridge on Route 2 in Richmond, which is a historic truss bridge. It's a Pennsylvania through truss. It's the only one left in the state carrying motor vehicles. Beautiful bridge, one of my favorite bridges in the state, but it's very narrow. We looked into being able to widen that bridge and make it more accommodating for cyclists, because Route 2 in that area is a big cycling area, but you'd have to destroy the historic integrity of the bridge to do it, and it would turn, I'm going to make these numbers up because I don't remember the exact numbers, but to give you some perspective, it'll turn a $5 million project into a $15 million project in order to widen that bridge.
William Jewett, your comments on that?
Well, I'd just like to bring up a project right in my area, which is really a great success. I'm sure John's aware of the Route 30 repaving from Middlebury out to Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
This is an area that's used extensively by Middlebury College students and others for riding and walking. And the pavement's deteriorated terribly. There are no shoulders. It's scheduled for paving in fiscal year 10, which is great. I don't know the entire cost of that paving job, but we worked really closely with the AOT. Took a lot of community work on this to get an enhancement grant to put in what we're hoping will be 3-foot shoulders all through this.
Yeah, now this is a good example of communities working together.
And we're just about out of time, I'm afraid. So can you give about 45 seconds, John Zaccone?
Yeah, what we're doing there is, knowing that there were these wants in the community, an enhancement grant is a different pot of money than how we pave. And we knew we were going to pave it. We knew that the community wanted this. We worked with them to apply for this. They were granted the award, and then we coordinated the two projects. So the repaving is paid out of one pot of money, and then extending the road with the shoulder work that is more costly is done from a different pot of money, and the two are able to work hand in glove. But we can't do that on our own because we can't take enhancement money as the state. The community has to apply for that.
John
and the
Zaccone.
Community and us work together so that we could do this there.
John Zaccone from the Agency of Transportation, thanks so much for joining us.
Very good, thank you.
And Willem Jewett from the legislature, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
Nancy Schultz, advocating for bicyclists statewide with the Vermont Bike and Ped Coalition. What's your website?
www.vtbikeped.org.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Carl.
Jeff Mapes, just 15 seconds on Pedaling Revolution, how cyclists are changing American cities. Closing comments?
Yeah, I have to say it's very encouraging to hear what is happening here in cycling in Vermont, and it just tells you that people are you know, dealing with these issues in community after community. You have legislative, statewide officials thinking about it, and you know, that's the beginning of change. So it's very interesting to hear.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Carl Etner. That's it for today's Equal Time. I'm going to get on the GMTA bus with my bicycle and head back to Montpelier after the show. Artie Levine produced the show. Check out the EqualTimeRadio.com website for audio from this show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
A Massachusetts doctor is making the startling claim that living with less oil can lead to longer, healthier lives. Since I think we're going to be facing oil shortages soon that will make gas lines of the 1970s look like cornucopia, I'm glad to hear that. Not only that, she says investments now can save $1.5 trillion, that's trillion with a T, $1.5 trillion every year on U.S. health expenditures. Few people have thought about what effect energy scarcity is likely to have on our health. When they do, mostly people talk about ways our present healthcare system may become crippled. Hospitals may not stay heated in the winter, and so on. Jill Stein is someone else. She's a former instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School, and she co-founded the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities. On August 7th, she spoke at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, and she didn't deny any of the challenges healthcare faces after peak oil. Instead, she focused on the big picture. Some of the worst chronic diseases in this nation afflict advanced industrialized countries in uniquely high numbers, Stein said. They're called the Western Disease Cluster, and they include diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. Alzheimer's may also be part of this cluster. The good news is, we know how to prevent them. When Stein was researching her book on environmental threats to healthy aging, she found that environmental factors have a huge impact on these chronic diseases. Lack of exercise is one big factor. Stein pointed out that the built environment often gets in the way of exercising. When you're surrounded by traffic, or roads are constructed with no place to walk, it's hard to get outside and exercise. On the other hand, exercise opportunities abound when life is designed for using less oil. You walk or bicycle to school, to work, to the store, and so on. We can change our built environment, make it more exercise-friendly now, because we want it to happen. Or we can find ourselves, in the not-too-distant future, walking and biking on our present roads, whether we want to or not, because of energy shortages. Food is also a big contributor to the chronic diseases Stein talked about. Diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. She said that the Mediterranean diet can reduce your risk of getting all of these. Foods included in the Mediterranean diet are lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, olive or canola oil, and fish. Legumes like lentils are an important part of the diet, which is low in red meat. When you do eat red meat, it's important how it was raised, Stein said. Meat from pasture-fed animals contains high levels of omega-3 fatty acids. Good stuff. Meat from feedlots, not so much. The Mediterranean diet both prevents chronic diseases and can help people who already have them. Stein told of a randomized trial of people in the intensive care unit of a hospital after suffering a heart attack. Some were put on a Mediterranean diet. Others were given a different diet, which was also considered to be heart healthy. Over 5 years, those on the Mediterranean diet had 70% lower incidence of new heart attacks.
A reduction she called incredible.
What's the connection of the Mediterranean diet to peak oil and energy scarcity? Stein pointed to Cuba in the 1990s as a country-level laboratory on the health effects of reduced oil availability. The collapse of the Soviet Union left Cuba without its subsidized oil imports, and it couldn't afford to buy nearly as much oil on the world market. A tightening U.S. trade embargo also forced Cuba to become more self-sufficient. Cubans were forced to walk or bicycle more, and to do more outdoor work and food production, and eat local food. The diet? Low in red meat, high in fresh fruits and vegetables. And people got healthier. Chronic diseases were reduced, and mortality dropped nearly 20% for all causes. Stein declared, "This is what health reform should look like." And that's the sort of health reform that can save real money. Getting rid of the environmental causes of chronic diseases, she said, can save $1.5 trillion every year if we make relatively small investments now. Sounds like a good deal to me. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.